books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today we've got debut novelist Roxy Key and her brand new book, The Deadly Spark. And following on from last week's interview with Greg Moss, we'll hear from Mark Lynas about Our Final Warning. All that and more on today's Read On. The Deadly Spark is a brand new psychological suspense crime thriller from debut novelist Roxy Key. Deadly fires are lighting up Brighton, and the latest case is alarmingly close to home for DC Eve Starling. The audio version of The Deadly Spark is read by Imogen Wilde.
The sensation of the phone vibrating in my hand makes me start. Without looking at the glowing screen, I hurl it into the ocean with as much force as I can muster, watching it sail through the air before being swallowed by the dark depths below. A spike of adrenaline burns through my body as I envisage myself stepping over, imagining the sensation of my body slicing through the cold air, plummeting into the darkness of nothing. I take a step closer. Just a few metres away now. Any minute. The sound of a dog barking in the distance makes me jump, and I turn on the spot, squinting in the weak light. Then, I see him. And he sees me. I don't have much time. I turn back to face the edge of the cliff, break into a run up the grassy slope, and leap.
The Deadly Spark is a part police procedural, part psychological suspense. It's about an arson attack that results in the death of a mum and her daughter. The mother's girlfriend is seen jumping from a cliff on that same night, and Eve Starling, who is a detective on the case, needs to figure out if it's grief or guilt that drove her to her suicide. But this case really brings up traumatic memories for Eve that threaten to get in the way of her solving the case.
Where did the character of Eve come from?
I really wanted to write a strong female lead who's really good at her job but also struggles to contain her temper and sometimes makes rash decisions. I was originally inspired by a few characters on TV. So she was initially like a blend of Rachel Bailey from Scott and Bailey and Cassie Stewart from Unforgotten. They're like my two favourite on-screen detectives. But obviously she morphed into her own person after a few chapters, and I really like how she comes across now. I've had really good feedback on her as well.
Now, I don't want to give any spoilers away, so I'll ask this question carefully, but were some of the scenes quite hard to write?
Yeah, so some were quite difficult emotionally. I think because of the subject matter involving a mother and her daughter being killed, that was always going to be really hard. I think now I've got a daughter myself. Since writing the book, I just don't think I could write something like this again. I think it would be too hard. But in terms of technically difficult, there was quite a few bits I had to research quite a lot. So I have no history in either crime or fire. So yeah, there was a lot of research to be done there.
Did you plot it out, or are you more of a pantser?
Yeah, I have to have every act and every chapter planned out, so I know what's happening. I think when I first started writing years ago, I'll write and see what happens, where it takes me. But it just ends up fizzling out for me. So if I have each act and scene planned out to a point, then I can just crack on and write it. And then I feel like I'm more creative that way. I think some people that are more pantsers find it more creative the other way, but I just get stuck. It just works really well for me, but it does mean I have to do like a huge plan on a huge sheet of paper with post-it notes and spend ages agonising over it. But yeah, once I get there, it does flow better.
And that must be doubly hard when you've got more than one timeline.
Yeah, it's I don't know why I do it to myself, to be honest. My segment, the one I'm writing at the moment's probably even more complex. I just, they're the books I like to read though, so I'm always going to write things with multiple characters and timelines, but it is hard keeping track and knowing where to put the flashbacks and make sure you don't reveal the wrong things at the wrong times in the wrong chapters. Yeah, there's a lot of back and forth going on with that as opposed to doing like a linear timeline, but it's fun.
Now, is the setting of Brighton quite important to you?
Yeah, I wanted to set it somewhere that I know really well, and I didn't want to set it in Northampton where I'm from because it's just not that interesting. But that Brighton's full of really interesting places, so things could happen, people could hide. And because I want to write it as a series, I needed somewhere where there's lots of opportunity. I think Brighton really covers that quite well. And I just love it there. Me and my wife and my daughter head over there as much as we can. So I think it's a really good setting for a crime novel.
And of course, we have a diversion to the Highlands as well.
We do. Now, I've never actually been there. I had plans go there, but then pandemic happened and I just never managed to go. I've been a lot via Google Maps and Street View, so I know the area of Plockton quite well, where I set the Anya chapters. I was looking for really remote places in the UK and I just really loved the sound of Plockton.
It's important that there's queer representation in the book.
Yeah, I've read a lot of books where the characters are full of straight white people with really boring names. It just doesn't really represent real life. So yeah, it's really important just to make sure my cast of characters represent different races and sexualities, just so more readers can see themselves in my characters, and just to represent real life more.
And talking of reaching more readers, the book is now available in audio. So is that important that it's now available to people who can access it, who can't, for whatever reason, access print?
Yeah, definitely, because I don't see why anyone should miss out on a great story because they can't access print, they can't read a book. Also, in terms of budget, I think it's great that there's so many ways to make audiobooks affordable. Like, I don't think many people know you can actually get them through the library. I only found that out last year. So I think they can be quite expensive. But no, I think audiobooks just such a good way to get more people reading.
Let's have another listen to a clip of the book read by Imogen Wilde.
The Fitbit on my wrist performs a celebratory buzz as I hit my daily step count target. It's not even 6 a.m, I think to myself smugly, slowing to a fast walk so I can chuck some water down my throat. I live for this time of year. The sun rises before 5, and I'm usually out the door shortly after, trainers on, the coastal wind whipping my face as my feet pummel the pavement that leads to the beach. Take that, Bells, I say out loud as my avatar slides into first place. DC Bella Cortez and I have been competing for as long as we've known each other. On my first day in the CID as a detective constable 5 years ago, she'd added me to the team's step count competition. Within a couple of weeks, everyone else had dropped out, but Bella and I never stopped taunting each other. We soon progressed to lunch dates, post-shift drinks, and wild ideas of running the Brighton Marathon together to raise money for the Sussex Police Charitable Trust. It hasn't happened yet, but our friendship has grown stronger and stronger. I pause to lean against the rusting promenade railings, pastel turquoise paint tarnished beneath my fingers, and watch the sea lapping against the pebbled shore. It's my morning ritual. Enjoying the peace before the usual onslaught of selfie-snapping tourists and ever-ravenous seagulls. Just me. And anyone else mad enough to be up at this time.
Imogen Wilde reading from The Deadly Spark by my guest Roxy Key. Roxy, did you have a hand in picking Imogen as the narrator?
Yeah, I was given 3 options. It was really hard to decide because they were all so, so good. Yeah, I found it hard to choose, but in the end, I decided on Imogen Wilde. I felt her voice really suited the characters better. I'm really excited to hear the book being read by her.
Now, I do ask this a lot, but do you not fancy doing it yourself?
No. No, I just, I don't think I have the voice for narrating an audiobook. I could just about manage a podcast, but lots of people have asked me that.
Now, one thing we do miss if we're downloading a book from RNIB Library is the cover. Could you give us a wee description of it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love it. I think HQ did such a good job with it. It's dark blue with an origami house on fire on the front, some really bright orange flames popping against the dark cover. It's really good. I love it.
Looking at your Instagram feed and your X feed as well, you look to be a fan of crime fiction going back quite a while.
Yes, I love it. It's my favourite genre. I read a book by Jane Casey in my early 20s. It was the first crime novel I'd ever read, actually. And someone had just brought a box of books in from home that they were letting us have first dibs on before they went to the charity shop. I thought it sounded interesting and I was just so obsessed with it and read her entire backlist. And then once I'd finished that, I was just looking to find something similar. And I just completely consumed as much of the genre as I could. And then I just thought, I need to write this as well. Yeah, it's just such a good genre to lose yourself in.
Do you listen to any of them in audio?
Yes, I've always got an audiobook on the go. I listen to them in the car or when I'm doing housework or even when I'm laying next to my toddler waiting for her to go to sleep. Yeah, I'm terrible for speeding them up though to get through them quicker so I can read more, which I shouldn't do. But I really do love an audiobook. So I've listened to some really good ones in the past with such good narration. My nan has macular degeneration. She's a massive book fan and she really loves crime fiction. So I love the fact that she'll be able to listen to books if her sight does stop her from reading.
My phone vibrates in my arm strap, shattering the peace of the summer morning. I slide it out of its pocket and see a text from Bella. Smirking, I prepare myself for a ribbing about overtaking her again. But I flinch when I see her message. You heard about the fire. If there's been another arson attack, this would make it the fourth in the area this year. Our team isn't the one investigating the serial arsonist who keeps breaking into people's homes and destroying their lives, but we haven't missed it on the news. As Brighton residents, we're all too aware of the destruction fire can cause. I can't help but let my gaze drift to the sorry remains of the West Pier, burnt to a smoking carcass in 2003. I remember standing on the pebble beach with my jaw hanging open, gripping my mum's hand as we watched it go up in flames.
The Deadly Spark by Roxy Key is available now in print as an ebook and an audio as narrated by Imogen Wild and should be on its way to the RNIB Talking Books Library soon. And Roxy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great chatting to you.
And if you're listening to this show on the day it was released, The Deadly Spark came out yesterday. And we'll have more from Roxy at the end of the show with the books of her life. But now, let's take our first visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
We have The Invisible Women's Club by Helen Parris, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
Janet Pym's chance at a new life almost went out with the recycling. She was crouching curbside, swiftly sorting the paper from the tin, before her neighbour Bev could collar her with yet another of her Befriend the Elderly overtures, when something in the newspaper caught her eye. Uncrumpling it, she carefully brushed off a leaf of Assam that hadn't made it into the compost caddy, and there it was. Her finger trembled slightly as she traced under the words. "Are you retired? A keen gardener? Would you like to share your enthusiasm for horticulture and historic landscapes with others? If so, this could be the position for you." That familiar logo, those dear snub-nosed leaves of the oak seeming almost to reach out to her. Janet read the advert aloud, savoured the words in her mouth, editing them slightly as she did so. "Share your enthusiasm and extensive knowledge of horticulture, particularly medicinal herbs and evergreens, with others." And of course those other words, sweet as honeysuckle nectar, which ran along the top of the advert. National Trust. What a heady rush those words left in their wake. What horticultural idylls they conjured.
Janet Pym is used to being invisible. 70-something, with her beloved allotment for company, She simply doesn't need anyone else. But when the local council threaten to close their allotments, Janet will do anything she can to try and save them, even enlisting the help of her irritatingly upbeat and interfering neighbour, Bev. As the two women set off on a journey together, Janet begins to realise that perhaps she isn't so happy to blend into the background after all, and that maybe there's more to Bev than she first thought. As they fight to save the place Janet loves most, both women find their voice again, and no one can silence them now. A story of friendship, community spirit, and the importance of connection.
It was Nancy who had first introduced Janet to the National Trust. Janet, brought up to watch her pennies, had balked at the entry prices, but Nancy waved her protestations away, and before long they would regularly round off a weekend's hiking with coffee and a walnut slice at a National Trust garden. Janet knew the job was for her, knew deep inside. She felt it as a yearning, pulling from her heart up the column of her throat to her lips, which opened slightly in anticipation and let out a small moan. From the moment the longing took up residence in the hollow of her breast, Janet sensed herself moving through her quiet, tapered life with a renewed sense of purpose. She felt a tilt to her shoulders that, if not exactly jaunty, was at least somewhat spry, and though it might be excessive to say there was a caper in her stride, it would be perfectly acceptable to describe it as a clip. She telephoned the number on the advert immediately to put her name forward and was told that all applicants would be contacted for an informal interview after submitting a brief online form. The link to the form would be emailed to her in due course. Due course? Why, that could be any moment. Janet raced upstairs to her chilly spare room, pulled the dust cloth off her grey breeze block of a computer, and thenceforth commenced a regular patrol of her inbox, which remained steadfastly empty. Until today. Gobbling her breakfast, Janet throws on her old fisherman's jumper, arms herself with a cup of Assam, and rushes to the spare room, taking the stairs two at a time, despite her knees and the tea slopping into the saucer. Why are you applying for this position? Offers a multiple choice of responses from to develop my knowledge and interests, to make a difference to the natural environment, but what really catches Janet's attention is to meet like-minded people and make new friends. Janet lingers for quite a while over that one. Like-minded people, she mutters, gazing through the plume of steam curling from her teacup, lightly stroking the tips of her fingers across her lips. There are a couple of further options to do with time and usefulness that Janet pretends not to see. Then she selects Other from the drop-down menu, which opens up a small box allowing her to input her own answer. She rolls her shoulders, flexes her fingers, and gets as far as to share my extensive knowledge of plants, particularly evergreen, before a warning flashes up informing her that she has reached her character limit.
The Invisible Women's Club by Helen Paris is read by Sylvestra Lee Towsell and runs for 9 hours 24 minutes.
For our readers who love history, HarperCollins recently donated The Palace, From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of History at Hampton Court by Gareth Russell.
5 centuries before the Tudors climbed onto the English throne, Hampton had been Hampton, spelt Hamtonne, Anglo-Saxon for the place, settlement, on the bend of the river. There had been settlements in the area since the Bronze Age, circa 2500 to 700 BC, and aristocratic estates during Roman Britain, AD 43 to 410. The site's early importance derived from its convenience to the river, its correspondingly fertile soil, and later its proximity to significant royal events, such as a church synod in 838 attended by the King of Wessex, and the coronation at nearby Kingston in 925 of Æthelstan as the first king of a united England.
Hampton Court has been an arc of monarchy, revolution, religious fundamentalism, sexual scandals, and military coups. In this rich and vivid history, Gareth Russell moves through the rooms and the decades, each time focusing on a different person who called Hampton Court their home. Beginning with the Tudors, Russell takes the reader from the kitchens of Henry VII and the dreams of Anne Boleyn to Elizabeth I's brush with death and the staging of Shakespeare's plays, to the commissioning of the King James Bible, the Republican victories of Oliver Cromwell, the many mistresses of Charles II, and their laxatious, laced attempts to embarrass one another. The gossip and feuds of Georgian aristocrats lead into the era of the Windsors, when Hampton Court becomes the place to host Elizabeth II's coronation ball and hide the last Tsar's sister. Fascinating and engaging, the palace is as atmospheric as it is gossipy, and through the many sovereigns and servants that lived and worked in its halls, reveals the personal tragedy and political importance of this extraordinary place.
Prior to his death in 1062, the manor of Hampton had been held by Elfgar, Earl of Mercia, courtier to the Saint King Edward the Confessor, and son of Lady Godiva, the noblewoman who entered English popular culture thanks to the colourful, and almost certainly apocryphal, legend that she rode naked through the streets of Coventry to shame her avaricious husband into lowering taxes on the beleaguered townsfolk. We also owe the phrase Peeping Tom to the legend of Lady Godiva, or Godgifu, to use her original Anglo-Saxon name. The story runs that the people of Coventry, touched by Godiva's gesture to humiliate herself on their behalf, agreed to turn away or keep indoors as she rode by, with the exception of a curious adolescent, Tom, who peeked from an upstairs window. Variations on the legend have him being stricken blind by God in punishment or murdered by his enraged neighbours. Elfgar of Mercia had the good luck to shuffle off the mortal coil 4 years before the invading Norman armies swept through England, all but obliterating the Anglo-Saxon nobility as a class. In the land redistribution free-for-all that followed, William the Conqueror, England's king from 1066 to 1087, granted Hampton to his cousin and companion-in-arms, Walter de Saint-Valery. Later generations of the Saint-Valerys served successive Norman and Plantagenet kings and fought in the Crusades, where Reginald de Saint-Valery encountered the warrior monks of the Order of the Knights Hospitaller of St. John of Jerusalem. Under the protection of the wealthy St. Valerys, the Knights Hospitaller began renting land at Hampton for an English chapter of their order. In the long run, those monks proved more enduring than their patrons come landlords.
The Palace. From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of History at Hampton Court by Gareth Russell is read by John Telfer and runs for 14 hours, 14 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And we'll have two more books from Lynn in a moment. But now, regular listeners will know last week we had Greg Moss on to talk about his climate fiction books, The Coming Storm and The Coming Darkness. And during that interview, we talked about Mark Linus's book, Our Final Warning. Here he is talking to Red Sail.
Mark Linus's new book, Our Final Warning, 6 Degrees of Global Emergency, investigates what happens if, as predicted, global temperatures rise between 1 and 6 degrees during the 21st century. It's a chilling, timely, and compelling reminder that the human race needs to change its ways. He joined me over Zoom to tell me more about his research and the book. Mark, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red. It's great to be with you.
Now, this really is our final warning, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately it is. And I titled the book that because I wrote an earlier, completely different version of this idea, if you like, the 6 degrees idea, looking at the future impacts of climate change back in 2007. And so I wanted to say really that we're now at a situation which, I mean, how to put it other than it is our final warning, we don't have any more time to go on putting off cuts to climate changing greenhouse gas emissions if we want to avoid some of the really more catastrophic end of impacts that I detail in the book.
Well, I was looking back at your previous book, which we also have in the RNIB library, and it's very depressing to see that a lot of the things that you've predicted have started to happen already.
Yes, it's depressing, but it's, I guess, reassuring that we've got the science right. So if the world had suddenly started cooling for the last 15 years and glaciers had started advancing again and we were seeing the opposite of what we expected, that would be really interesting. But the fact is that things have pretty much played out as was predicted back then by computer models and expectations for what warming would bring. And some of those impacts are pretty depressing. I mean, I remember snorkeling on coral reefs, maybe in the 1990s. All of those are dead now. And it was one of the earliest things which was predicted, big outbreak of coral bleaching across the world's tropical oceans. And something like half the Great Barrier Reef has now died. So it's not comforting to see that the scientists have been right about some of the worst things that would happen, and which have happened in some cases much earlier than was originally predicted.
In the book, you break it down degree by degree as to, well, the canaries in the mine that will die if we don't stop heating the world's atmosphere. What happens if we only increase by 1 degree?
Well, we're already in the 1 degree world. So that chapter is describing the impacts that we're already seeing, such as the mass disappearance of the world's corals. And also the melt of Greenland and Antarctica has really defied all expectations and happened more rapidly than certainly I was expecting 10, 15 years ago. Greenland was losing something like 600 billion tons of ice, which was enough to raise global sea levels by 2 millimeters in just 2 months. We've seen also the very rapid disappearance of the Arctic sea ice. In fact, in the UK at the moment, we're having this very strange seesaw between an incredibly wet period in the late winter, and February was really wet. And now we've suddenly got the sunniest and probably the driest spring ever. And so you're actually seeing weather patterns stuck in these configurations, which may well trace back to the disappearing Arctic sea ice. So these are some of the things that we're seeing, and I actually quantify in the book what the amount of extra heat is that's now being captured in the Earth system due to this increasing amount of greenhouse gases which we've got accumulated in the atmosphere. And it adds up to 6 zettajoules per year, which is 6 to the power of 21. And it's the same heat as 3 Hiroshima atomic bombs exploding in the oceans every single second.
Goodness. And at 2 degrees?
Well, at 2 degrees, we'll sadly see the loss of about 99% of the world's coral reef. So it'll be a biome which more or less ceases to exist across the planet, and the first of many, unfortunately. We'll see tens of millions of more people exposed to exceptional lethal heat waves. We'd also begin to see impacts on the world's food supplies, which is something I'm very concerned about. Given that we're projected to see population growing to 9 or 10 billion by 2050, if we see a net reduction in the amount of food which is available, that would reduce the amount of calories available per person. And the projections at the moment are about another 500,000 additional deaths from malnutrition by mid-century. And there's also, in terms of the Earth system, the risk of tipping points. So we'd lose about 40% of the permafrost, that frozen ground in the Arctic, which when it melts, releases methane and carbon dioxide in the hundreds of billions of tons potentially. So even if we arrest the warming at 2 degrees, all of that extra carbon coming from the Arctic permafrost could then take us over that level and continue the warming further than you'd want. So that's always the danger, really, is that if we continue emitting fossil fuels and allowing the warming to accelerate, then that probably triggers tipping points in the Earth system, which then, while not necessarily making it unstoppable, add more warming into the system in decades to come.
Now, the book has been brought vividly to life by narrator Richard Burnip, and I always think it's quite a difficult job to bring this kind of book to life in an entertaining way that doesn't just confront you with endless statistics. Did you have anything to do with his selection as a narrator?
I didn't, and I wasn't even aware until I looked up on Amazon. But he sounds like one of those people who just has a wonderful voice for nonfiction and, as you say, really brings something to life. So I'm delighted that it worked out that way and that he was able to voice the book.
And do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
Never. It's funny, actually, when I listen to podcasts, I just wish I could put things on double time and just speed it up. I need to get through a lot of information as quickly as possible. I'm not a complete speed reader, but I do quite like being able to skip ahead, which is something you can do with text on a page and you can't obviously do with the more linear format of audio. But so no, I'm not much of a podcaster or an audiobook listener, but I know a lot of people are, and it's so great that it's a format that really works for people.
Well, actually, you can speed up the rate at which you listen to an audiobook with all the main providers. So perhaps that's a new area of research for you.
Yeah, I'll give it a try in that case. I don't know whether the pitch of people's voices goes up if you speed them up by two or three times, but that's certainly a risk I'm prepared to take. So I'll give that one a shot.
Well, most of them will give you a free trial. But in the meantime, let's have a listen to Richard Burnip narrating Our Final Warning by my guest, Mark Lynas.
I can't tell you with any precision when the globe will reach different temperature levels in the future. This is not so much because the science is uncertain, although to an extent it is, but because the rapidity of warming this century will depend on decisions yet to be made about how far and fast carbon emissions continue to rise. If we stay on the current business-as-usual trajectory, we could see 2 degrees as soon as the early 2030s, 3 degrees around mid-century, and 4 degrees by 2075 or so.
Your book is incredibly well researched. It has rather been your life's work over the last 15 or so years. Do you see a coming together of scientific and political will on climate change, or are the two still separated by the need for votes and economic success?
Before the pandemic, I felt there was a real sense of momentum. You had the school strikers movement, Extinction Rebellion in the UK and elsewhere. And so the protester end of things was really beginning to capture the mainstream. And in the UK, we've got now a net zero target, which was unthinkable 10 years ago when I was writing the first iteration of this book. So I think it's okay to be encouraged by that. But we've got to make sure that we meet these targets and hopefully even exceed them, because at the current time, the pledges that the world's governments have put forward to meet the 2015 Paris Agreement don't meet the targets of the Paris Agreement, which was 1.5 to 2 degrees. In fact, if you add all of the government pledges together, it takes us still all the way up to 3 degrees, which is pretty unimaginable in terms of the scale of the impacts that we'd then experience. So there's just a huge amount more to do, and we need to not lose the momentum that was there before the pandemic. And in fact, we need to take the lessons that we've learned from dealing with a global crisis in the very short term and somehow leverage these lessons into dealing with the climate crisis, which is more obviously of a medium and a long-term challenge.
So if we imagine ourselves in 10 years' time, where do you think we'll be?
Well, I'm not a futurist, and while this book is a scientific project, it's also a piece of advocacy. So I want to change the kind of world that we see by writing a book like this. And one would hope that issuing a final warning of 6 degrees would help, to whatever small extent, push forward that momentum that we, I think, are seeing in terms of how climate change is dealt with. It's very difficult to make predictions about what kind of world we're going into, even in the very short term, of course, because we don't know how rapidly we're going to be able to exit from the pandemic. We don't know what the economic situation is going to be, whether it's going to be one of panic and collapse or a much more managed recovery. If it's the latter, then we have a higher chance, I think, of pushing with recovery funds into a much more sustainable future, because there'll be a need for a lot of investment and job creation, and that can go into things which decarbonize the economy. The thing is, you can probably tell from my tone, I'm a fairly irrevocable optimist. I don't know why. I mean, there's plenty of stuff to be pessimistic about, but there's also things that we've successfully achieved in the past. We don't have a population of, what is it, more than 7 billion by accident. It's because we've been incredibly successful as a species in harnessing the planet to meet our needs with food production and modern healthcare and those kinds of things. So it's incredible what humanity can achieve when we as a species put our minds to something. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't have equal success with at least limiting the more dramatic impacts of climate change and not destroying the one planet that we have and call home.
Well, I think that's a good optimistic note to end the interview on. Mark Lynas, thank you for leading us through our final warning, and let's hope that your optimism is borne out when I come to interview you about the sequel in a few years' time.
I will return with great joy, and we'll look back together on how successfully we dealt with this crisis. Yes, let's end on that note.
Our final warning, 6 degrees of Climate Emergency, joins Mark Lynas's other books in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Thanks to Red Seal and to Mark Lynas. In a moment, we'll have two more brand new books from the RNIB Library.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books, crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. I suppose favourite books. Well, Roddy Doyle springs to mind. All the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me. And it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. Death to all dogs who enter here, we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge, sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. The hiss of the water and the earth so soft, bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there, staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books, and I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
For lovers of history, we recently acquired The Black Prince by Michael K. Jones from Bloomsbury.
On 15 June 1330, a son was born to King Edward III and his queen, Philippa of Hainault, at the Royal Palace of Woodstock. The king was a little distance away at the time of the birth, and he granted a servant, Thomas Prior, a life annuity of 40 marks, £26, 13 shillings and fourpence, a considerable time in 14th century England, for bringing him the happy news as he hastened to his wife's bedside. The boy was their first child and was named Edward after his father. The new parents were a young and attractive couple. The 17-year-old king was physically striking, already almost 1.85 metres, 6 feet tall, well-built, with strong regular features and long, flowing hair.
As a child, he was given his own suit of armour. In 1346, at the age of 16, he helped defeat the French at Crecy. And in 1356, he captured the King of France at Poitiers. For the chronicler, Jean Froissart, he was the flower of all chivalry. For the Chandos herald who fought with him, he was the embodiment of all valour. Edward of Woodstock, eldest son and heir of Edward III of England, better known as the Black Prince, was England's preeminent military leader during the first phase of the Hundred Years' War. Michael Jones uses contemporary chronicles and documentary material, including the prince's own letters and those of his closest followers, to tell the tale of an authentic English hero and to paint a memorable portrait of warfare and society in the tumultuous 14th century.
A handsome young man, Edward was well suited to the close of the period, with their bright colours, sumptuous materials, and liberal use of fur and jewels. He was a natural extrovert, a lover of display, tournaments, and pageantry. But he was also intelligent and charming, possessing the ability to talk easily to people from all walks of life. A man who made an immediate impression. Beneath what seemed an easygoing nature, he was brave, ambitious, and proud, with a driving, restless energy, although these qualities had not yet fully shown themselves. His 16-year-old wife was even-tempered and kind. She genuinely loved her husband, and over time would accompany him on military campaigns and prove to be an exemplary mother to her children, the firstborn, Edward of Woodstock, the Black Prince, and then eight others who would survive infancy. She took considerably more interest in them than was usual for a queen in this period. The chronicler Jean Froissart praised her as wise, gladsome, humble, and devout. She was hard-working and intelligent, and would become a notable patron of scholars and artists. The days after the birth of their son were a happy time for Edward and Philippa. The king went hunting in the neighbouring forests, and during the following month held a tournament in honour of his wife and baby son.
The Black Prince by Michael K. Jones is read by Hamilton MacLeod and runs for 16 hours, 41 minutes.
Reader favourite Sebastian Foulkes has just published a new book. The Seventh Son was donated to RNIB by Penguin Random House.
"Letter for you, Talissa," said the superintendent, holding out an envelope from his desk in the lobby. "A letter? Wow, is this the 19th century? Looks important." "Sure does," said Talissa. It bore the embossed initials of the body that would decide her future, HLI, the Helen Lingard Institute. "Aren't you going to open it?" "No, thanks, Marlin. I prefer to take my bad news alone." "I like the boots. They new?" "You kidding me? Postdocs don't do new." Talissa pushed open the door onto the avenue. The rattle of the new electric tramway, a smell of tar and burnt chestnuts. As she strode over the big paving slabs, the wind pushed the woolen dress against her thighs, and her coat rippled out behind her.
When a young American academic, Talissa Adam, offers to carry another woman's child, she has no idea of the life-changing consequences. Behind the doors of the Parn Institute, a billionaire entrepreneur plans to stretch the boundaries of ethics as never before. Through a series of IVF treatments, which they hope to keep secret, they propose an experiment that will upend the human race as we know it. Seth, the baby, is delivered to hopeful parents, Mary and Alaric, but when his differences start to mark him out from his peers, he begins to attract unwanted attention. The Seventh Son is a spectacular examination of what it is to be human. It asks the question, just because you can do something, does it mean you should? Sweeping between London, New York, and the Scottish Highlands, this is an extraordinary novel about unrequited love and unearned power.
She skipped down the subway steps in the first hint of winter rising from the Hudson. Near the study centre was a cafe where she sometimes retreated. She ordered more than she could afford: plum compote with yogurt, poached egg, and a pot of dark roast Colombian. "Right," she said softly to herself as she sipped the first of the coffee. "Let's go." She pulled open the letter. "Dear Talissa Adam, postdoctoral research position. A full complement within the limits of our budget. Short of one pair of hands in the ideal cohort. Admired your resume and supporting letters. Guarantee a place if you were able to externally fund your first year, starting in the fall of 2031. The worst. She could call her mother for some commiseration, or speak to Felix. She could call her best friend, Susan Kovalenko, but Susan's sympathy might make her cry. It was better to champ down on the disappointment by herself, digest it like a python with a kill. She looked round the cafe and its bare wooden surfaces. There was a framed photograph of a jazz trumpeter at the foot of the stairs and a vase of gaudily coloured flowers, zinnias perhaps, on the counter. The espresso machine hissed and thunked. Talissa paid and went across to a small park nearby, a scratch of grass with a struggling green ash. In the corner was a bronze that showed a mother and two children walking away, hand in hand. One child was about 5 years old, light on her feet and confident. The younger one looked new to walking. Talissa thought of the fossilised footsteps discovered in the volcanic residue of the Rift Valley in Tanzania, where the trail suggested that a child had at one point been picked up by a parent, perhaps because the ground was too hot on its feet. A plaque said the bronze was a memorial to a steamboat accident long ago, but to Talissa, the figures looked like any group of hominins. From the highlands of Uganda to the sidewalks of Manhattan, the hope and duty, the mother doing what she thought was best, but no wiser than the children who'd placed their hands in hers. Talissa's work had made her see all human beings in this way, as primates first, Homo second, and sapiens later, if at all.
The Seventh Son by Sebastian Foulkes is read by Miranda Raisin and runs for 9 hours 29 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show, let's return to novelist Roxy Key and the books of her life. A book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes, and it's probably a massive cliche. Harry Potter. I read loads before I got into that when I was younger. I read Famous Five and things like that. A lot of adventure type stories. But yeah, I just fell in love with Harry Potter, and it was like such, it just really wowed me. It was like my biggest way to escape life. I just loved it so much. And then I thought, well, I want to write this. And then I went through this phase of, I'm going to write children's stories, fantasy stories. And it turns out it's really hard to write children's fantasy stories. But yeah, it was the thing that made me want to be an author, for sure.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense. Mr. Dursley was the director of a firm called Grunnings, which made drills. He was a big, beefy man with hardly any neck, although he did have a very large moustache. Mrs. Dursley was thin and blonde and had nearly twice the usual amount of neck, which came in very useful, as she spent so much of her time craning over garden fences, spying on the neighbours. The Dursleys had a small son called Dudley, and in their opinion, there was no finer boy anywhere. The Dursleys had everything they wanted, but they also had a secret, and their greatest fear was that somebody would discover it. They didn't think they could bear it if anyone found out about the Potters. Mrs. Potter was Mrs. Dursley's sister, but they hadn't met for several years. In fact, Mrs. Dursley pretended she didn't have a sister, because her sister and her good-for-nothing husband were as un-Dursley-ish as it was possible to be. The Dursleys shuddered to think what the neighbours would say if the Potters arrived in the street. The Dursleys knew that the Potters had a small son too, but they had never seen him. This boy was another good reason for keeping the Potters away. They didn't want Dudley mixing with a child like that.
That's Stephen Fry reading from Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling, book one in the Harry Potter series, available in the RNIB library in both audio and braille. Now, do you have a book on a rainy day you can happily curl up with and reread?
Don't really reread things. I just have such a big pile of books to read. But there is one thing I would like to go back to reread, and that's the Jane Casey Maeve Kerrigan series that I started in my early 20s. I really would love to go back and read them from the start. There's about 12 or 13 books now, though. But yeah, that would be a real comfort read for me. Even though it's a crime novel, I still find it comforting.
I didn't know where I was or what I was doing when the phone rang. I didn't even know that it was the phone that had woken me. I came up from miles below the surface and opened an eye as one part of my brain tried to work out what had disturbed me and another part focused on how to make the noise stop. It resolved into a low rattle that was my phone, vibrating crossly on the bedside table, along with the high-pitched shrill of the most annoying ringtone I could have chosen. Fumbling for it in the dark, I sideswiped it and managed to push it off the table. It fell face down in the carpet, still ringing, the sound now slightly muffled. I'd winged it, but not killed it. The bonus was that now it was a little bit harder to reach. I leaned out of bed at a dangerous angle, raking the carpet with my fingers, trying to get to it. Most of the nuance was lost in the pillow, but I interpreted Ian's comment as, "Answer the phone," which was pretty much what I was thinking myself. Along with, "What time is it?" and, "What does this idiot want?" I got it at last and stabbed at the buttons until it stopped making a noise, trying to read the screen. Langton, Rob. I squinted at the time and read, 0327. Half past three in the morning, and Detective Constable Rob Langton was calling me. I was waking up now, my brain starting to crank into gear, but my mouth hadn't caught up with the change of plans and was still slack with sleep. When I said hello, it sounded slurred, as if I'd been drinking for the last, I worked it out, 3.5 hours, instead of having some much-needed shut-eye. 3.5 hours. That made 6 hours of sleep in the last 48. I squeezed my eyes closed and wished I hadn't added it up. Somehow, knowing the numbers made me feel worse. "Did I wake you, Kerrigan?" I would have recognised the Manchester twang anywhere. "You know you did. What do you want?" I asked, but I already knew. There were only two reasons why Rob Langton would be ringing me at that hour of the morning sounding excited. One, there was another body. Two, they'd caught the killer. Either way, I wasn't going back to sleep any time soon. "Got him." "No way."
The Burning by Jane Casey. Maeve Kerrigan, Book One, is narrated by Caroline Lennon, Paul Thornley, and Penelope Rollins, and available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind and you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, I read a lot of things recently. I think my favourite I'll go with an audiobook, as we're talking about those. And one of my absolute favourite authors, Gillian McAllister, it's called Just Another Missing Person. It's a really clever thriller about a detective who's blackmailed into framing an innocent person for murder in order to keep her daughter safe. Yeah, I could not stop listening to that one. Really, really good. Good twist.
Julia is trying to work out if the man at the table next but one is somebody she has arrested before. He's ordering a caramel cheesecake, out with a wife and two children, and she's pretty sure she once charged him with murder. The lighting is low. She just can't tell. She is trying not to let her husband and daughter know what she's seen, eyes down on the menu. Nando's is cringe these days, isn't it? Genevieve says. Julia smiles at her arch only child. In what way? Art says, bristling. Art, after Art Garfunkel. Her husband. An English teacher. A pedant. A ditherer. The last man still using semicolons in text messages. And until recently, the love of Julia's life. The cheesecake arrives at the maybe murderer's table. Julia watches him as he looks up. He has two phones, both face down on the table in front of him. A dead giveaway of a criminal. She's pretty sure it's him. Something about the brow. Oh, just, you know, cheeky Nando's and all that. Like, give it a rest, Genevieve says. She picks up a menu. She's in a black halter neck, tucked into high-waisted jeans, large gold hoop earrings. She looks amazing. But she wouldn't care if she didn't. That's Genevieve all over. She does whatever the hell she likes. Sometimes Julia is pleased to have raised a strong woman like this. Sometimes less so.
Just Another Missing Person by Gillian McAllister is available commercially as narrated by Joanne Froggatt and should be on the way to the RNIB Talking Books Library soon. And once again, Roxy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's lovely chatting to you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. But remember, this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer. That we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.